Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Aura, the all-in-one application that protects your safety online powered by AI. Honestly, it is worse to just be a human that exists on the internet from a safety perspective than it ever has been before. I'm constantly getting weird scam phone calls from everyone. I'm sure you guys do too. There are lots of weird phishing attempts that are made to internal employees at Blockworks and on Twitter. So I have to do these posts that, hey, I'll never ask you for money. It just is terrible. The actual statistics is that 1 in 4 people now fall victim to cybercrime. And if you operate in crypto, it is even worse. You are more at risk. That's why we're happy to partner up with Aura here. And I'm going to be telling you all about them later in the show. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode, but for now, on with the program. All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined by Dan Tapiero of 1RT. Dan, welcome to the show.
How are you? 1RT and 10T Holdings.
Right? And 10T, yes.
Forget about old 10T, yes. But no, we're all good. Good to see you. Glad to be back.
Yeah, you as well. I was just saying before we got on, there's very little to complain about given what's going on in the world. So feeling pretty good. Sounds like you're doing
well. In our world.
Yeah, right. Well, Dan, I want to actually start. You and I were getting into the weeds a little bit before we got on. But before we get into the weeds of what's going on in the digital asset ecosystem, I want to rewind the clock back to end of 2022. You and I actually met in New York. And at that time, when everyone was just max bearish, you know, you kind of shared with me and Jason that you were extremely positive on the market, and that turned out to be a really good call. What were you seeing back then that gave you the confidence that the market was going to do what it did?
Oh, you know, I've talked about this a few times, so the people in your audience who've heard this already, just bear with me. But look, after the FTX debacle, which to me was the most surprising thing in a sense, because surprising thing for the markets, because, you know, even 6-7 weeks earlier, he was a guy, you know, worth $25 billion, highly respected, you know, I again, by the, you know, general crypto and external crowd. And so I think that the speed at which that guy fell, was a surprise to everybody. And even though we did pass on investing in FTX 3 times, I certainly, you know, I didn't like it as an investment, but I didn't think or know that he was a fraud. I just thought there were some things that didn't make sense to me. And the valuation was extremely high, and I just felt it was a greedy valuation. So, we passed on that. But the surprise of that shift from that, where he was to where he ended up being, was, I thought when it happened, the most shocking thing that would happen in the bear phase. You know, we had 3AC, that was sort of a minor fund. We had other things that happened, but this was the big one. And on the announcement of this, the day that it sort of broke, the Ethereum price couldn't go down and make a new low. And the Bitcoin price went down, I think made a new low, but then came back. And so, for old time sort of macro traders, this is famously called a bullish divergence. So when you get the most negative piece of news that you could imagine after a protracted bear market, if you can't make a new low in price on that kind of news, it tells you that the selling has dried up and that the bear market is over. And so I... You know, I was texting with another one of my LPs who's also an old time macro guy. And I said, is it really going to be this easy? Like, usually the lows are, you know, it's just difficult. And you never want to try to actually pick a low. And he's like, yeah, that's it. You know, and we just sort of had our back and forth. Like, that's it. That's the end of the bear phase. And so the absolute low happened in that period, in the, you know, week or a few weeks after FTX. And I put this out on Twitter, and I wrote all sorts of things about, you know, that it was so dark that, you know, darkest before dawn situation. And I wrote a whole bunch of things on Twitter. So that was the end of the bear phase and the beginning of the bull phase. But, you know, early bull phases take a while to develop. And I can remember, and what happens during bull phases, and this is what happens, you know, with all markets. This is consistent that, you know, happens in bonds and stocks and, you know, anything you could possibly imagine, commodities, is that you continue to get negative news and it continues to not have an impact on price. Perfect example, a little later on, of course, in the people were telling me, oh my goodness, Genesis is going to DCG entity. The Genesis is going to declare bankruptcy. This, you know, the market's going to get killed. So they came out, they declared bankruptcy. The market went down for maybe, I don't know, a few hours, if even that. And I was like, oh, there's another sign. The bull markets digest negative news. And they, what they do is they climb a wall of worry. And that's a very old, you know, Wall Street, you know, dictum. And so the, you started getting more negative pieces of data that were increasingly having zero impact and starting to turn into bullish drivers. And perfect example was the day that Gensler came out and announced the suit against Coinbase. The stock essentially rallied immediately. And within a few weeks after, I think it was a few weeks, at least a month after he had actually sued them, the stock was up 200%. And that was in the summer. So it's just, there were a lot of signs like that throughout 23. Now, me being able to convince people of this, that's a different thing. Even with my track record, having been in the markets for 30 years and, you know, having raised this fund and having, you know, 300 investors and deployed $1.2 billion into all these different sort of growth and larger, you know, companies, growth stage, larger companies in the space, it was still very hard for me to convince people, even people who I, you know well. And the SBF trial then in Q2, Q3, that was another negative that gave people another reason not to enter the market. So I don't want to say this was one of the easiest, you know, bull periods that I can recall, but I, you know, the way the market responded to the news and also during most of, like, certainly the second half of 22 and in 23, there were some tremendous, like tremendously bullish underlying developments happening in this sort of broad digital asset ecosystem. You had the, just for instance, you had the amount of stable coins that were settled. I think in 22 hit 8 trillion. Now, 2 years, 3 years before, that number was zero. So it was growing throughout 21 and 22, and it kept growing. You look at things like the number of Coinbase verified users. That kept growing. You looked at the monthly active users of the top 10 blockchains. And that number continued to increase throughout 22 and 23. So there were some very bullish things happening that didn't happen at the end of the last bear phase in 18, 19. I mean, if you recall then, and, you know, stop me whenever you like, but if you recall then, people were really talking about Bitcoin going to zero, ETH was below 100. It was like people felt like this is, could this really be it? Like, could this really? And this time, it was not even close. If you looked underneath the hood and you did the work, and I know you're sort of deep in the DeFi weeds, and I know US DeFi collapsed. But it didn't, did TDL ever get below 50 billion or 40 billion? I mean, that's still a huge number, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, the
it's
innovation.
It's 100 billion today, I think, right?
I think it is. And, you know, I think, Dan, you put your finger on exactly what it was. If you were, especially the deeper you were into these like weeds of crypto, the less this even felt like a bear market. I mean, here's another little indicator for you. You remember 2018 to 2019 consensus, 2018, biggest consensus, they got 15,000 people. Next year is 1,200. This year, or last year, in the absolute depths, the worst period to be working in crypto, you got 20,000 people going to multiple conferences per year. That's,
yeah, in Singapore.
That's a clear investment.
In Singapore,
no, I didn't go to Singapore, but I went to Paris last year. Yeah. There were three or four that had that number of people. I mean, it's totally different world.
Yeah. In Singapore and in Asia, they have a little more of a, you know, blockchain gaming focus. I mean, Korea, you know, is specifically focused a lot on that. But I was in Singapore in September, and literally, what was it, 15,000 people, 400 side events. Like, you got mobbed. And I mean, probably Bitcoin was 25, 30,000 then. But that had already gone up 100%, right?
Right.
I think it was, you know, for the first half of the year, there were, you know, comparisons probably made, right, of last year. So I agree. And that's really what's changed. It's broadened out dramatically. And unfortunately, we talk about this every single time, but the traditional press doesn't do the work. They only report on sort of gotcha stories. They want to report about Sam Bankman-Fried. They want to. So the news in the traditional world is just so negative. And of course, we've talked about this in the summer. Larry Fink kind of put a stop to some of that. And he said, you know, again, 2 years ago, Bitcoin is for money laundering and a fraudulent kind of thing. And then in the summer of 23, he says, well, it's an important global asset. And you know what? I think we're going to bring the ETF too. And so that was the end. That was the flashing green end of the bear market. If you didn't pinpoint it on this trading divergence I mentioned, I mean, that was it. And because he's, you know, one of the five probably most respected traditional world financial people in the U.S. He just is.
Yeah.
Whether you think he's a great investor or not, it doesn't matter. He runs a giant business. He's been massively successful. And his opinion really changed. And you saw it in these interviews. I think that's what it wasn't. He wasn't just lip service, paying it lip service, which some guys do. Like, I don't really believe Ray Dalio, for instance, understands this stuff. I don't think he's done the work. And I just, when I hear him speak about Bitcoin, I just don't, he doesn't get it in the way that Larry Fink got it, right? And all us guys in the space, we see that. We see like, wow, Larry Fink really is on board now. And I think that was a big deal. Like, and that to me was the end, right?
Hey everyone, we partnered with Aura for this episode to keep On the Margin listeners safe from cybercrime. I talked about it at the top of this episode, but cybercrime and phishing scams have basically become the bane of my existence. I get 10 spam calls every single day, every day. I'm sure you guys do too. And my co-founder Yano has actually been hacked multiple times, you know, knock on wood, God forbid, this past year. So it's just never been less safe to operate on the internet, especially if you work in crypto, it's particularly tough. That's why we partnered up with Aura, which is an all-in-one app that provides protection for your identity, financial accounts, passwords, devices, all of that stuff. Now, the benefit of Aura, there are many benefits, but one, it's AI. So you immediately get notifications if someone is trying to hack into your bank account, social media, whatever it is. So you know really quick. But in addition to that, what they do is they will actually help you solve the problem. So with 24/7 US-based support and dedicated resolution agents, Aura will actually be there every step of the way to help you resolve whatever is happening on the fraud front. And for a limited time, because Aura just loves On the Margin and you guys as listeners, we are getting a free 14-day trial plus 55% off an Aura subscription when you visit aura.com/blockworks. Only get that discount if you go to aura.com/blockworks, which we've linked in the description. So go check them out. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer 2 that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need. And Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's E-N-G-N. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, and priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launch on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
Dan, here's something I'd be curious about. In one of the interesting things, at least about the ETF for me, was that this was the most telegraphed catalyst that we've probably ever had in crypto. I mean, this is 10 years in the making as a catalyst. And people had a really good understanding of when this thing was going to go live, et cetera. But there was a huge debate leading up. Is this a buy the rumor, sell the news, buy the rumor, buy the news? And clearly, this was a buy the rumor, buy the news. Dan Moorhead got that exactly right. Why is it in crypto that even something as major as the Bitcoin ETF, like, why did that not get priced in from your standpoint?
Well, I mean, most of the players in the crypto markets, I call them are civilians. They're not professional money managers. They don't know much about portfolio management, risk management. You know, they're mostly 26 to 34 year old guys whipping and driving stuff. And they just, you know, it's just the way it is. Which is just the same thing as saying the market is very inefficient. And that's why we're all drawn to it, because if it were efficient, I wouldn't be involved. There's nothing that's interesting for me. And probably for you too. It's not efficient. There's huge amount of price discovery that's still happening. And I think also, look, this is a once in a lifetime kind of phenomena, you know, the birthing and evolution of Bitcoin. And I don't think, you know, we can have a view on the price of Bitcoin, which I have for a long time, and where I think it can go. But we actually don't know how it's going to get there. We don't know when it's going to get there. We don't, you know, there are lots of different things that we just don't know. And so, you know, we don't know a priori how the ETF, we didn't know how intense the interest would be, but I don't want to say it was obvious, but I read, this wasn't my thought necessarily, but I mean, I've been thinking this, is that, you know, basically in one day, you onboarded $100 trillion of global wealth. Like, it's like Coinbase onboarding, you know, 100 million or whatever number of clients in one day, right? Because anyone who has a stock account, so it's not just in the US, it's globally. There are a lot of people who have equity accounts in Brazil, in, you know, France and Canada, everywhere around the world. And so all of a sudden, every single person with an equity account could just push a button. All those guys trading on the Interactive Brokers platform, all those guys, every single person. Okay. So I put out a tweet I think before the ETF or right after the ETF was launched. And I said, you know, it's funny. People were talking about, oh yeah, buy the rumor, sell the fact, this and that. And I said to myself, the one thing people are not really talking about, I think it's potentially a danger in a good way for us vis-a-vis this ETF, is that, and I remember the launch of the gold ETF in 2000. I mean, is that in every other case, the ETF, whether it's the gold ETF, the oil ETF, even the US Treasury ETF, okay? In every case, when the price goes up a lot, there is a supply response. So if the gold ETF leads the gold price and doubles, gold miners dig more gold out, period, right? Mm. The same thing. Oil goes to 150, and all of a sudden, the US will invent, you know, fracking and all that tar sands. I remember, you know, people said, oh, the Canadian tar sands. Well, you got to get to at least $50 on oil or $45 for that to be, you know, a profitable endeavor. That was when oil was at 30, you know, and at 25 and 30. And the same thing, treasuries, right? If you take treasury yields up to a huge number and the yield goes down to zero, you get massive issuance, right? More supply. This situation is not like that. And I don't know that the ETF powers that be understand that, because there is no price that we can go to that will elicit a supply response. And so yeah. what you've done is you've brought on literally $100 trillion of money in global equity accounts that can now push a button and buy Bitcoin. So when you think about it like that, I mean, these people have been waiting years to buy Bitcoin. They didn't want to. I know them. I mean, I have investors who are this way. Oh, I'm just going to wait for the ETF. For 2-3 years, they don't care. And I think that's what's a little different about this, is that you have people coming into the ETF who really are long-term buyers, people who wanted to buy. They're older people, and they just didn't want to figure out how to set up a wallet, you know. And it can be confusing, I guess. So
it can be. The, you know, the Geminis and Coinbases of the world have improved quite a bit, but you can go back 5 or 6 years ago, wasn't super easy. And there's a huge psychological mental hurdle to setting up a Coinbase or Gemini account that doesn't exist with the ETFs. But Dan, I'm curious to get your take. So I heard you just say, like, maybe this is something that's a little bit different this time. One of the things that at least I'm trying to wrap my head around is, if you look at the pattern of crypto cycles in the past, like, the two things that tend to play out is, like, the peak to trough gains are a little bit lower on each cycle, just a law of large numbers things. And the amount of, like, the Bitcoin dominance, the percentage of Bitcoin as the overall market cap gets sort of lower. And these things go in peaks and troughs, right? But I'm trying to understand this time, like, is that going to change with the advent of the Bitcoin ETF? Should we be expecting something of, like, a longer, more pronounced cycle? Is this relationship of Bitcoin being less and less of the overall crypto market going to change?
I think this is easy. This is just an accelerant. You've got, I just said, $100 trillion that's now available that wasn't before. And the more the price goes up, the more FOMO, this and that. And look, last time in the peak in 17 was 20,000. When we broke that, we went up to 60. The new high was, or call it 69. I don't care. We just call it 60. So now we just broke 60. We can go to 180. That's three times. And why is that? That's not crazy. So I think, you know, 150, 180, I think that's a pretty, you know, if you want to be a little more conservative and say 120, I mean, that just means Bitcoin's going to double from here. I don't think that's such a big deal for Bitcoin holders. I do think that what's important for me now is that the value is getting really big. And of course, as you know, I called my first funds 10T, 10 trillion, because I think that's where in 2019, when the space was 300 billion, I said, okay, well, the value of all the cryptocurrencies and the value of all the equity is 300 billion. And my target over the next 5 to 10 years, conservatively, would be 10 trillion, which is a 30X. And I thought to myself, no one in the traditional world or nobody I know is going to believe that that was actually my view, right? So I'll just put that into the name of my fund, and there it'll be cemented, right? Because there's never been a money manager who has put his view into the fund, and the view was a 30X, right? So I know.
So that was you, Babe Ruth, calling your shot there.
Yeah, and also I don't mind being held to account. You can look at all of my tweets since I started and moved into this space. And, you know, I've made mistakes too, and you can see them. But my, you know, broad call has been right on, and the structure of the fund that I have invested was built right out of my experience and my background, and was meant to be a kind of, I call it a sleep well at night exposure. You know, I don't think we'll be the single best performing fund in the space, but I think for the risk we will be. And I still think there are huge gains to be made here. So when I talk about the value, Bitcoin going from 60 to 120, ETH going from 3,500 to 10,000, you know, you're talking about the entire value of this digital asset ecosystem, you know, being worth north of $10 trillion. And I think that's at a point where it really is here, right? It's arrived. At 10 trillion, it's arrived. And then people from the old world who were not interested when I was talking to them in 2019 and 20, and, you know, for a moment, maybe in 21, they were interested, but then again in 22, 23, it was all fraud and this and that. I think up at 10 trillion, it becomes, there's enough dollars, there's enough value and enough people, and the network effect has been created that people really start to do the deeper dive, right, into the space. All these people buying the Bitcoin ETF, by the way, they only know that there's Bitcoin. And maybe some of them know that there's Ethereum, but they don't know that there's anything else. They don't know about, let's say, ordinals. They don't know about, I don't know, all of the different proof of stake cryptocurrencies. And again, I think Bitcoin and Ethereum are the core assets of the space, and everything else is essentially a venture project. Solana is maybe moving like in between those two places now, you know, in attempting to achieve network effect. And I think it will. You know, that's not my expertise necessarily, but I do think that this world that I've envisioned for a while, where everything of value will eventually be put on a blockchain and reside in this big digital asset ecosystem, I think we're moving towards that. And, you know, it's funny because I am in a way like a Bitcoin maximalist. I really am. It doesn't sound like that. And I'm not, you know, Saylor's fantastic. And I love all those, you know, those guys who are Bitcoin only. But the reality is, at least in my view, is that I don't ever want to spend my Bitcoin. And I don't think anyone who really wants to spend their Bitcoin. I don't want to move it out of cold storage. I don't need to get yield on it. I don't need to do anything. I just, it's put away, and that's my Bitcoin. And so if I think that that's the best expression of it for me, I feel like that's the best expression for everybody. And so if every single person is just put away their Bitcoin, that's great. The value goes up, because there's no supply, but all of these different like needs and use cases, you know, RWAs, I think there's a huge place for the growth of real world assets, you know, the tokenization of real world assets. And I even like central bank digital currencies, philosophically, you know, you may not agree with them. They will exist, right? Everything of value is going to be fungible on these blockchains. And this has always been my view. So it can't only be that there's only Bitcoin, because the rational thing to do with your Bitcoin is to never sell it. So it never leaves. It's not, you don't use it for anything, right? So if you don't use it for anything, but there are all these other things that you could use a blockchain for, right? So I think it's funny to say that I'm a Bitcoin maximalist, but then I'm also a believer in this sort of multi-chain, you know, world, where I think that there are lots of these projects that, you know, are solving real problems. And NFTs, I think, are, you know, are a phenomenal use case. You just have to listen to Yat Su, the chairman of Animoca, for, you know, 30 minutes. And if you're not convinced, you know, I'll give you your money back.
Yeah. And, you know, Dan, it's funny. You know, we were just talking about Larry Fink, and Larry Fink started with Bitcoin, but he's moved on to tokenization. And honestly, I'm excited. I know we're going to be seeing each other in London in a couple of weeks for DAS, but this is the kind of stuff we're going to be talking about there. There's the Bitcoin story, which is the monetary story, but then you sort of look at these computer networks and you say, hey, maybe this is an interesting construction for, I don't know, hosting bonds in a more secure way, transferring them around the world, stable coins, stuff like that. And all these things, I think institutions are starting to look at and explore pretty seriously for at least the first time that I've been in the space. So it's cool. Now, what do you think, Dan? What is the sort of underlying, like when, even when we talked back in like end of 2022, you were also constructive on the macro side of things outside of this whole digital asset ecosystem.
Yeah.
And again, most people, even outside of crypto, they were not, right? This was, everything's going to zero. We're going into the next Great Depression, all of this stuff. But you were sort of the lone voice saying, hey, I actually think we're about to enter a period of expansion, innovation. And that's largely been proven right over the last, you know, 15 months. So what, again, what did you see back then? But what's your sort of current macro read as well?
I just thought that, you know, the world has never had so much total debt outstanding. Maybe as a percentage of GDP, it's not as great as it was maybe at some point. My guess is that I am not tracking it that carefully, but I just thought you can't go from zero to five in 18 months without it blowing up a huge constituency, number one. I don't know who they are, but there's no way. Without the total sort of, I would call it, decimation of the U.S. housing market. Forget about like people borrowing at 7 or 8% to buy a house. Like that's dead. Also, you know, every time the Fed has raised rates a lot quickly like that, I can remember 1994, and 1994 was the worst year for the bond market since 1930. Since 1929, I think. And I remember it blew up the macro community. Guys who have been up 80% in 93, like we're down 50% or 30% or whatever. And again, then Mexico blew up in early 95. And so I thought also that when rates go from zero to five, there are many foreign countries that are pegged to the dollar that won't be able to manage that. Like, you know, you go to Hong Kong rates were zero. And now they're five because they have a direct peg to the U.S., right? It's a monetary board. So that real estate market, I don't want to say it's vaporized, but certainly China's real estate market is vaporized. I was in Hong Kong a few weeks ago, and people were miserable. Honestly, the stock market is at a 19-year low. I mean, imagine, like, you didn't invest in NASDAQ, and instead you went in the Hang Seng. I mean, you're annihilated, right? And then I started hearing about all these defaults on commercial Chinese real estate bonds. People like literally buying these distressed bonds at 80 cents on the dollar, waking up the next day and there's zero. And I think it's billions of dollars were lost. So you don't move from zero to five on the Fed interest rate, the Fed funds, without, as I said, blowing up some things and blowing some things up in the foreign area. People forget how much of the world economy is still dollarized. Like the entire Middle East doesn't have its own currency. There is no Saudi rial, you know, Dubai dirham. There's none of that. It's all just pegged to the dollar. One for one, pegged. And it has been forever and ever and ever. So when interest rates move like that, their rates go up a lot. And so I just thought, okay, well, rates, we kind of discounted that. So you asked me before about why didn't the Bitcoin market discount this? Because again, it's an early market with, you know, not as many eyeballs looking at it. The treasury and the stock markets, they are very smart. And the NASDAQ, you know, bottomed way ahead of, you know, the peak in interest rates, right? Almost a full year. Because, and I've said this before, the investors in tech are the smartest investors alive today. I just mean the pure brain power, right? To really understand, you know, how AI works, to really understand even like crypto, how DeFi works. It's just very complex. And in the 80s and 90s, the smartest guys were the bond traders. All these guys from MIT, you know, you had the Black Scholes and, you know, it's just all of these genius guys came to Wall Street and they invented the mortgage-backed market and the asset-backed market. And they were really, you know, CMO structurers. These guys were all like PhDs in math from MIT. They were the smartest guys. And I think that, you know, that market, I think there's been an exodus from sort of the bond market. Real talent that's coming out of college, young guys, they don't go into the bond market like they used to. I think they're going to work for tech firms, for venture, and I think in Q4 22, there was just a realization that the Fed was hiking rates to a degree that it guaranteed the economy and certainly 100% the inflation was going to slow down. And so a tech investor comes in and says, okay, I think, you know, 4, 3, 4, 5% on the Fed funds rate. If I'm buying tech on a 5-year hold or a 10-year hold, and I'm getting these discounts, right? Q4 22 is the low in the NASDAQ as well, I think. I can buy now. The price is low. So what if the Fed raises another 100 basis points? It just solidifies the fact that inflation is going to drop. And so that market priced that whole Fed thing in early. The Bitcoin market doesn't have that ability. So when the interest rates actually do begin to drop here significantly, Bitcoin will explode completely because that market doesn't have a sense for what the macro is going to be. It doesn't have the ability to discount ahead of time. And I wrote that today in a tweet. I said, look, 10 years, if they break 4%, they're going to 3.5. The employment numbers are going to start to soften. I think the ISM employment component dropped. If we just start to slow down in the growth of employment, we'll be down at 3.5, 10 years. I think that alone would take Bitcoin to 90,000, 100,000, just that. And I think it's supportive for NASDAQ as well, for the latecomers. So what I saw was just the discounting mechanism that is the NASDAQ, the smartest discounting mechanism, sort of saw all of this ahead. And because they're the smartest guys, because they're have the longest outlook, you know, the long-term, and have the ability to buy into weakness, that was it. It was just, you know, it was a crescendo of selling, and it was as dark as it could be. And, you know, that's it. And that's how lows are put in, when you can't imagine anything more negative. And then the risk becomes that you need to be long. So I also think this is the decade of innovation. I've said this for 4 or 5 years. I agree with the Cathy Wood thesis. The 2020s will be like the 1920s. I think we've got a multi-year run here. The 7 companies that are driving things are completely unique businesses. I understand people quibble about valuation, but the reality is they are non-replicatable businesses. There is no Microsoft popping up in Malaysia or France or Canada or whatever. It's just not happening. And the same thing for these large companies. They're just so dominant. They're sitting on tens and hundreds of billions of cash waiting to deploy into an area, you know, where they think is the sort of the next, you know, hot area, the next area. And who's better to judge what the next big trend in tech is than, you know, Elon Musk, right? Or Bill Gates or, you know, any of these guys, Larry Ellison. I mean, they just, so I think what's really happening is this massive, and this isn't particularly new, but what's happening is the old world businesses are getting destroyed. And, you know, Cathy Wood, again, a few years ago said, oh, the U.S. banking system will cease to exist in 10 years. I don't know if you remember that comment. She said, oh, there won't be any banks. And I was thinking, well, that's a bit aggressive, but that's a call. And I don't think she thought, okay, there will be fewer banks because treasuries are going from 0 to 5 and all of these community banks don't know how to manage risk and they're all going to be caught long bonds. I don't think she was thinking that and that would wipe them out. But that's sort of what happened. I mean, the, you know, there are a lot of amateurs managing portfolios, you know, at these small banks across the country. And so we have 4,000 banks, I think it is, and the rest of the world on average will have what, 30 to 80 in each country. So you're having a collapse in the traditional areas of business that aren't really that innovative, that don't really do much, right? Like, okay, small banks, real estate. You know, people have thought that real estate was a store of value for 100 years, more. But I mean, a real store of value. And I think we're going to start to see leakage out of that, you know, and come into our space, which is a sort of a different thought, right? That there are all these different assets that, you know, historically have been used as store of value. Art, right? Real estate, hard assets. I do think Bitcoin and gold to a degree, but I think Bitcoin is a superior store of value. And so over time, very slowly, you're going to see leakage from these old world assets that just aren't that interesting. So I think that's the big change going on. And the more the banking system has trouble here, dealing with these rates, the more the housing and real estate areas have trouble, the more bullish it is for tech, because it just means that the Fed is going to have to accommodate. It can't let that big a chunk of the economy just go to zero, and they won't. So I think it ends up being massively disinflationary. And you're seeing it a little bit in China. You know, the Chinese, the rates have dropped quite a lot. I think they'll probably start to stimulate housing and real estate markets are too, you know, under too much pressure. And also, you know, if you look at Ed Hyman's work at ISI, at Evercore, I think he's fantastic. Last week I read one of his notes, and I didn't realize this, but the UK and Germany both had back-to-back negative quarters of GDP in Q3 and Q4, which is officially, you know, according to the old guys, that's what a recession is. A recession is two back-to-back quarters of negative GDP growth, Q over Q, seasonally adjusted annual rate. And so, you know, in the Bitcoin space, we're not, you know, it's booming, right? There's no, it's the opposite. NVIDIA and all the stuff floating around, you know, the tech world, it's all booming. But Germany, UK, these are older economies, right? They're not really, you know, tapped into innovation in the way that the NASDAQ is. So that was a very long-winded response, but I hope it gives you some sense. I don't know. Did I not answer?
No, you did. You did answer the question. I mean, I think that's the, like, a lot of people are very torn in between, because it was like the positive view of this, which is, wow, look at all these great technologies. Look at crypto, look at AI, look at the innovation that's happening. Maybe parts of the economy that don't really make sense are sort of dying off. But then there's the maybe more negative perspective, which is we're running these massive deficits, like $2 trillion per year deficits, and that's funneling money, that's pushing people out on the risk curve and causing them to do all sorts of weird stuff. And that would be the other, like, slightly more negative perspective. But I agree with you. I heard Kathy Wood many, like, probably 5-6 years ago, is when we were getting started out with Pomp. She was recording an interview, and I heard her give this price target for Tesla. This was pre all the stock splits, so this isn't going to sound that impressive. But, you know, she said her base case was something like 400, and her bear case was, or her bear case was 400, or her base case was something like a, you know, 1200. And I just thought that was the most Looney Tunes prediction. I actually called Jason. I was like, I can't believe Kathy Wood just said this. She was dead right.
Yeah. Because she's had the right big macro focus, which is on innovation. That's what's interesting. And I don't remember, certainly in my life and 30 plus years in the markets, there's never been a time where things have been buzzing in this area to this degree. Like, even in the mid 90s, you know, you had internet and Netscape, and then you had eBay and all these exciting things, Amazon came. But that was like one thing. You know, today you've got robotics, you've got crypto, you've got AI, you've got, and she lists 10 or so different areas. You've got health tech, and productivity boom has got to be just gigantic. And I don't know that the traditional numbers really capture that. Also, work from home is fantastic. The ones that don't like work from home are these giant companies that, you know, I think they're sort of past their sell by date. Yes, JP Morgan is dominant and Jamie Dimon wants everyone in the office and it's worked for them and the stock is high. Okay. But you know, that's at the very, very top, right? I always say like at the very, very top, generally things don't change that much. The guys who are the best 1% at anything, you know, they just remain regardless of work at home. Now work from home productivity, they figure out how to win. But I think it's opened up an enormous amount of total work that's possible. Think about, there's so many things. You know, I go back to remembering that comment Mark Andreessen made, and he said that, and this is like right after COVID, and I wonder if he's changed his mind about this, but he said that the work from home movement would have bigger impact on Western civilization than the invention of the internet. He said that. And I was shocked, you know, Netscape founder and generally super well-respected genius tech guy. But you could see that, right? You could see how people moving away from cities, the younger generation, I just don't think we're going back to the old world where people are driving 2 hours to New York for their job and sitting at a desk for 8 hours and then driving home 2 hours. It's just it's a tough life, and tech has made it so that we really don't need to do that. I think you need both, right? Like it's great to do things in person and meet people. But just think about how much more efficient you are, how much more you get done having a mix of that. So I think there are things that are like that that aren't really, I would say, quantified well. Like how do you really quantify? Because I don't think the official productivity numbers really capture that change. And what about all these new areas? Like all of these, I think it's a little silly, but like all these influencers, there are people making $10 million a month. I don't know, doing whatever it is on YouTube or online, selling something or having a community, that whole concept. Just never existed before, right? They're big dollars. People, I guess the middlemen are continue to be removed, right? You have, you're continuing to remove middlemen, from many economic processes.
Dan, I want to get back a little bit to crypto and Bitcoin. Your target baked right into the fund name is 10T, right? So here we are, we're sitting, and the total crypto market cap today is around 2.4 trillion something.
Well, no, that's just the cryptocurrency 2.4. I add in all the equity of all the companies, which is another, today it's probably another trillion, depending upon how much you think Binance is worth. Because it could be 100 billion, could be 200 billion. Could it ever be monetized? I don't know, but it's still, a gigantic juggernaut. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. So including the equity, so call it three and a half trillion, just for easy round numbers. Where do you think we wind up this cycle? And we've got this sort of, third body, which has disrupted this 4-year cycle of crypto, which is the ETFs. Has that pulled forward a lot of the price appreciation and growth? Give us your sort of mental model and framework.
Well, this is the normal cycle. So it happened a little earlier, but come on, people have been talking about institutional adoption for 5 years or more. I mean, maybe not five. Yeah, probably. And like, this is the form it's taking. I think some people, like Saylor, thought that it might take the form of like corporates buying, putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet. I never thought that that was something that would happen quickly, because those are the most conservative, buttoned up people in the world who are running Fortune 500 companies, and it's just too much risk for them. Eventually, maybe, but that was the first group that was going to adopt Bitcoin were always going to be the investors, whether they were institutional money managers or high net worth individuals. And so the ETF has, you know, made it easy for them, and especially Americans who essentially hold, you know, a big chunk of the world's wealth. So I don't see anything really different. As I said, we broke the high. You can just very easily say, okay, I can go to 150, 180,000. But realistically, I think the cycle is the 10T cycle by 2025, 26. I think 18 to 24 months. Now, it could happen much quicker. And I always like to give myself like cushion to be wrong about the price. You know, give myself more time. So I think that's really reasonable. You know, the max case, I mean, could we get to 300,000, 350? Certainly possible. Yeah. I don't think this cycle we get more than 300, 350. I think that's probably a bridge too far. I think that's when people would be like, well, this has run too much. It may be worth that, you know, by 2030, but I think it'll be too much and people will have too much embedded gain. So the only supply, I said before, there's no supply response. The only supply that can come to the market are people who decide they want to sell because now they have money to buy the house for their, you know, that they've been wanting to buy, or buy that car. Or so people will trade their Bitcoin in for material things. I wouldn't, but, and I think a lot of Bitcoiners won't, but there is some price where a majority of people, especially younger people, say, you know, okay, now I can live, you know, can live in the Caribbean and travel around the world, and I'm going to trade my Bitcoin in for that. I think that's the only supply that'll be available. So the price has to get to some number where there are enough people who say, okay, that's enough for me. And then there'll be some number, and then they'll be selling, and we'll have a new bear phase. And, you know, there'll be, you know, that'll last just like this last one, 2 years, and probably go down 70% again. You know, but if we're going down 70% from 350, you're just going back down to 100, right? Like, who cares? It'll feel bad, but, you know, and then we'll have another second, and then that's the cycle. We go to a million.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that dynamic of supply coming back online from people who are selling to take profit is like, that ends up being so much of whatever goes up must come down at some point. But it's really been trucking on this pretty phenomenal journey.
It just started. I mean, if you think about, I mean, this whole ETF thing, it just, the momentum, it just started like a few weeks ago. So we're going to have a great year. Just hold on tight. Don't get too excited. Don't get emotional. Just put your seatbelt on. And this is a great time for you to build your business and bring people into the space and educate them. And that's what you do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think London is going to be very successful. So.
Yeah, thanks. This is one of those, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience, right? You were just saying at the beginning of the program, it's tough even for guys you've known your entire life, or for a really long time, your 30 years in markets. You know, when the price is going down, people just don't really want to listen. Like, my mental framework has always been these periods of time when it's going up, this is when you get the new crop of people that come in. Some crop of that people will leave during the next bear cycle, but it's a higher base every time. And this is kind of the, so if you're out there listening and you're like in this space and you want to be an evangelist, like, this is the time where there's a return on being an evangelist, you know?
I know, it's crazy. I, you know, you can't get people to buy when the prices are good, they just want to feel the FOMO and they want to feel the emotion of it. And that's why most people don't make money in the markets, you know, because they don't like being alone in the crowd, you know, outside of the crowd. And those are really the only times to buy and also the times to sell. And when everyone tells you you're a genius and, you know, there's max sort of emotional, you know, excitement, and you start hearing these crazy stories about Bitcoiners, you know, buying, you know, 300-foot yachts and this and that, then, you know, then it's time for another bear cycle. I mean, I think it's pretty natural. Also, the desperation that was felt post SBF, that was another thing that made me pretty confident that the lows were in, because, you know, if you trade enough cycles and you've lived through enough of them, you know how it feels. And there are all these signs. So I think we're in the third inning right now of this bull market. This is the acceleration phase. And you go from the third inning to sort of the sixth inning in this massive run up. And then, you know, you get some of the latecomers and seventh, eighth, and ninth innings. And then you know, hopefully, if you're a trader, you take some profit. If you need the money, you take some profit. If you believe in the big vision, you just sit back and watch your asset value grow.
Yeah. All said, Dan, I feel the exact same way. I mean, this is one of the most dynamic spaces to be working in. There's so much interesting stuff going on. Wouldn't trade it for anything.
Most really. I've ever seen. Yeah.
Yeah. Dan, if folks want to either follow you, the work that you put out on Twitter, or learn more about 10T, 1RT, like, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, One Roundtable Partners, and we also have a 10T Holdings. We put stuff out, go to the websites, you know, it's very simple, 10T fund, 1RT fund, and you can see what we have done, what we're doing, and a lot of different ways to capture value in this space. And the remarkable, well, I'll leave you with this, the most remarkable thing to me, I tell you, is that, you know, we are right now, as far as I know, the only growth equity fund in the world that's exclusively focused on crypto, blockchain, Web3, digital assets, whatever you want to call it. You know, maybe there's one or two guys out there I'm not really aware of. There are a bunch of VCs who focus on early stage who have floated a little bit into our area. But when I launched this and had the idea for this, I thought, okay, we've got, this is in the middle of 19. I thought we had got 3 or 4 years and then all the big guys are going to come in and I'm going to, you know, no way will I be able to compete. And what you saw in 21, 22, you saw people come in, Thoma Bravo, Tiger, a lot of these crossover growth equity funds. And they, many of them have, for the most part, moved out. And so I'm just very surprised that we are here today. You know, we've invested in 24 businesses, as I said, allocated $1.2 billion. I've got 12 board seats, if you can believe that. There really is nobody still. So, like, I have lots of different ways to measure where we are in the big cycle. And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, the big private equity funds are just not in this space yet, in my space. And so I figure I still have got quite a few years. I'm thinking 10. At least 10, before someone big like Blackstone comes in and says, we think this is a great area. And then I'm toast, you know, that I'm not going to be able to compete with those guys. But who knows? I think that, you know, there are all sorts of other signs out there, that tell you that it's still relatively early, you know, in the evolution and development of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
There's a ton. We felt the same competitive pressure from, you know, trad media, and every top of the cycle, I always think they're going to come in. you know, people told me in 2021, 22, oh, Bloomberg's dedicating a team of 50 people. Like seriously, there's someone raising $25 million, $50 million for this. And, you know, the bloom comes off the rose. And you know what it is, Dan? No one, there's no buy-in at a senior place in these companies. Like, you show me one of these companies, I will show you like two 25-something crypto guys fighting for their life for budget internally, and they're not, they're just not getting it, you know? Right. I mean, yeah.
Right. Well, so, that's why Larry Fink was so important, because he is one guy. Also, you know, Franklin Templeton, Fidelity, their leaders there, actually both women leader CEOs there who are on the cutting edge and really, you know, have bought in, right? Van Eck, of course. But you're absolutely right.
Franklin Templeton came out of nowhere. And frankly, of all of the people
that built it for a while, just behind the scenes. Yeah.
It's not something I knew. I met Jason, got off a call with their team probably 9 months ago, and was like, these guys get it. And they're, of all the natives, like they're probably the most native out of any of the really big companies that I've spoken to. So yeah, shout out to Franklin Templeton. Dan, this is a ton of fun as always. I'll see you in person soon. It'll be a good one. Good. We'll grab food.
Thank you.
All right. Cool. Thanks again. Dan.